that, people are dying, people are getting sick. Oh, well, shucks, darn, we really didn't realize when we put a reserve there. It's just, it's, oh, God, it just it drives me up the wall. crazy people in the government, you know, crazy people, you know, don't belong in government. They belong in institutions with straitjackets. Exactly. Government is an institution.
Institution is the problem, therefore.
Yes, yes. You know, it's like whatever happened to government for the people by the people. Right, that's down south. Yeah, right.
Turn into an anarchist show now.
I don't know. It's, well, that's the thing. First Nations, let's face it, you know, it's like a lot of us are. You know, we're activists. You know, it's like we've been, I was born into this. You know, my mom and just like, before I could walk, was telling me about First Nations issues. And she's like, remember, you're a Mohawk, Turtle Clan. Remember that. And she drilled it into me for, like, years.
As far as I'm concerned, though, like, activism, blah, there's a stigma around activists or whatever. But activism is about advocating what makes sense, right?
Exactly, yeah.
What doesn't make sense is what we see everywhere. So it's like,
that's really sad. It's like no one ever listens to the activists. They just like they send their stormtroopers in. And
there are exceptions,
are exceptions, but those are the ones who like end up getting really cushy jobs with like the CBC and the CTV and all that interesting network stuff where they just. It's funny. It's like you take a look at a good activist who's like fought for years, then he gets a cushy job at like the CBC and forgets exactly what he was there, what he was fighting for. He completely just.
Hello, this is Radio Free Thinker. We're seekers, you're all seekers. Right now, we have The Who and The Seeker from 1970. Well, it seems like we're having a little problem with the song, and we'll try and get our technical crew to work on that. Hello, Ethan. Welcome. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you? And, wow, that's loud. So, this is Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan. I am the free-thinking historian, and I'm joined by Don.
The philosopher and political science aficionado. So, today in history, we have a few things in history, but probably one of the most interesting ones that demonstrate the whole point of why the scientific method is such a good thing. This date, in 1919, Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity was tested by Arthur Eddleton in an observation of a total solar eclipse done in Brazil. Now, what this did, it was showed that light actually bended because of gravity, and that proved Einstein's theory of relativity. It's interesting to skeptics because up until that point, everyone said, Einstein, your whole idea of relativity, it's really, really crazy, right? Now everyone says, oh, he's a genius. But at that point, everyone was kind of going, this is a nuts idea. But the scientific method, you take an idea, you test it. If the tests prove to be true, then you have to scrap whatever ideas you had before and accept the new evidence.
Yeah, and this is great because science needs to be reproducible. It can't just be true in Vienna or England. It needs to be true in Tokyo and Toronto and Washington, Brazil, for instance. And this is great because Einstein's theory was proven again and again, and it's still being proven to this day.
To this day, I mean, even though, you know, some people will sit there and say, listen, there are some things it can't explain. And that's true. You get some things where quantum mechanics work better. But that doesn't mean the theory itself is wrong. That just means science needs to progress more. You get the same thing with evolution. Does evolution cover every possibility? There are some things they're not sure about yet. But that doesn't mean the underlying fundamental principles are true. Same with relativity.
Certainly. There's a few holes in evolution. Doesn't mean the whole theory is wrong. Just means we need to do some more research.
I think actually, too, I mean, Einstein himself was inspirational to science and all that. Another thing that happened on this date, for reference, is John F. Kennedy, American president, announced the Apollo project, where they promised to put a man on the moon before the end of the decade. Now, that's scientific what's the word I'm looking for here?
Foresight?
Seeing into the future. Foresight. Isn't that a great word, foresight?
Yeah. Well, you know, and it was a profound achievement that all of humanity can be pretty proud of, not just an American achievement. And It's kind of funny. I mean, you have this huge major breakthrough, and there are people out there who say, no, it was all fake. But
you mean the studio where they faked the Apollo landing?
Yeah, I think Stanley Kubrick directed it or something.
Something like that. Well, actually, I think who directed it was Kennedy. Because these same people say that Kennedy wasn't actually shot. It was all part of a plot to swirl him away.
Yeah, I saw that movie too. It was Oliver Stone. Really good.
Yes.
Pretty good. Well, it's another important event is that this is actually our 10th episode of Radio Free Thinker. Kind of surprising, actually. But, you know, so it's a great thing. And, you know, the traditional gift is diamond jewelry, so...
See, a skeptic mind, you're going to go online, you're going to check that out, and you're going to find out it's aluminum.
And tin.
Well, aluminum is good because we can fashion it into hats and prevent the aliens from sending in their little waves to control our brains.
Yeah, well, you know, hopefully we won't have to resort to that at this stage.
On a more serious note, in my home province, or province I was born in, Manitoba, there's an interesting case going on, which I think raises some ethical issues that we're going to get into later on in the show. Right now, there's a custody battle going on between a couple of parents and their children. The child's being taken away because the parents are instilling in them racist ideas, Aryan Nation, white supremacist ideas. The child went to school with a little swastika on their forearm. The teacher said, oh, you shouldn't have that, wiped it off. Next day, the kid comes back with it. We're talking about a 7-10-year-old. I forget the exact age, but about 7 or 10 years old. Next day, comes back with it on. Explains to the teacher about how black people should all be killed, and she knows how to. And she says anyone who's white should be killed. Who isn't white should be killed. And teacher hearing this, obviously enough, was a little alarmed and contacted social services, and the child was taken away. And right now, there's a debate going on whether the free speech of the parents should be infringed and teaching their values to their children.
Yeah, well, this has always kind of bugged me, but the idea of like free speech, you have free speech. You're allowed to go out there and make racist comments. What you don't have the freedom to do is avoid the consequences of your actions. You know, Don Imus makes racist comments. That's it. Yeah, he has the freedom to do that. What he doesn't have the freedom to do is say, hold on a second, I don't need to deal with that. I'm allowed to say it. But no, you have to deal with what you say. You can't just say something and be like, well, you know, I live in North America. I have the freedom to say whatever I want. Fine. Deal with the consequences, though. If you're going to make a racist statement or raise your kids to be white supremacists, you got to deal with that.
Well, and all the things that go along with that. I mean, we'll assume that the parents themselves have never done a bad thing. But your child, if you instill a child in hatred, and from what I understand from the case, we're talking violent hatred here.
Yeah.
Right? There's a good chance that child will go on to perpetrate that hatred. But I think another interesting aspect here is for parents. I mean, how much do you own your child? As in, one of the cases is, it's my child and I can do whatever I want with it. And I don't know, that somehow treats it as if it's a piece of property, that the child has no rights or society has no claim.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because we have other cases of society coming in and taking children away. But in some cases, it's because the child, precisely doesn't, because the child doesn't have rights. So they're making a life and death situation, as we've heard in recent news story about a child refusing to undergo chemotherapy. He made a choice, but the state says this child is too young to make a life or death choice. They don't have the maturity, so we're going to take them away. I mean, it's a debatey issue. It's not an easy thing to make a ruling on. You know, does the state own the children?
Well, but do the parents own the children?
That's another question. Who owns the children?
Exactly. And again, what right does a child have to its own thing? I mean, it is. It's a slippery slope, right? But I mean, there are some cases, and I mean, hate crimes in Canada qualifies that. And I think hate crimes can be quite broadened because I think our definition is actually limited. But the idea is that the child doesn't have a choice on whether it should learn this or not learn this. And the parent is polluting a young mind in a way that is not only detrimental to the child, but detrimental to society. And in that case, I think the rights of at least the individual should be protected, and the parents should not harm the child in this way.
Right. So again, very interesting debate. We'd love to hear our listeners' take on it. So please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. You can follow our blog at ubcfreethinkers.blogspot.com. And of course, follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. So let's go to a quick commercial break, and we'll be back with our interview.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Which you called the Big Trail. Well, I've made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days...
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that...
CITR!
Can be mighty helpful.
Yeah!
Hello, listeners. We're back with a special guest in our virtual studio. Today we have Dr. Philip Plait, a.k.a. the Bad Astronomer, an internationally renowned author, astronomer, and lecturer. His blog, badastronomy.com, has just been rated by Time magazine as one of the top 25 blogs on the internet. Time says his blog regularly battles the misuses of science in daily life, in addition to praising the wonders of legitimate research. Hello and welcome, Dr. Plait.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
As our listeners know, this show is intended to present and promote a skeptical view of the world, to show why it's necessary and what dangers arise from a lack of skepticism. For you, what does it mean to be a skeptic?
Well, for a lot of people, what they think of when they think of the word skeptic is someone who denies something or someone who's cynical. But that's not really it at all. A skeptic is just someone who wants evidence. If you present an idea, we don't just believe you. The idea is that you need to show us what evidence you have for that claim. So if you say, a ghost visits me every night, and I'll ask you what evidence you have for that, and you say, well, I see it. And then I can say, well, you know, studies have shown that when you're waking up and you're half awake and half asleep, it's easy to see stuff like that. I need photographs. I need more evidence than that. And so that's what it is to be a skepticism. It's not to deny stuff. It's just to ask for the evidence. Probably the most ironic thing about being a skeptic is when people say, you're a skeptic, you're closed-minded. And in fact, we're quite the opposite. We're open-minded. Somebody who believes in one of these things typically is closed-minded to the idea that they might be wrong, whereas a skeptic is always, in the back of your mind, always thinking, am I wrong about this? And if I am, you know, what is correct? We want to find out what the truth is. And so therefore, you have to always be open to new evidence.
Do you think there's a moral weight upon those who propose these pseudosciences? I notice you've written a few articles about the anti-vax movement and the deaths that have resulted from this movement.
That's been something of a soapbox for me lately because it's getting to be a much stronger movement. Jenny McCarthy, the ex-actress, is promoting the idea that vaccines are linked with autism. And we are completely sure they're not. All the studies show they're not. And yet... she and other people who are strong in the anti-vax movement are saying things that are demonstrably incorrect. And what's happening is we are seeing the effect. Vaccination rates are becoming lower in places like Australia, places where people are getting fewer vaccinations, and we're seeing measles outbreaks, whooping cough. There's a whooping cough outbreak in New South Wales, which is where Sydney is. I mean, this is not some backwater place. This is an urban area, and kids are dying. A little girl died of whooping cough very recently because she was too young to get vaccinated, but there were not enough people in her area who had been vaccinated, and you lose the herd immunity, this idea that if enough people are vaccinated, there's no place for the disease to live, and it goes away. Because the vaccination rates were low, this poor little girl got whooping cough, and she died from it. That's the result of uncritical thinking, of believing in stuff without looking at the evidence.
Do you think that vaccination should be mandatory?
Oh, boy, I don't know. And that's one of those things where that's a difficult, difficult decision. It's for the good of the public to have a 90 to 95% vaccination rate, and you're talking about saving lives. But it's no different than the arguments about wearing a motorcycle helmet or forcing people to wear a seatbelt. You're infringing on their liberties. And, you know, is it legal or is it correct for the government to legislate things for your own good? And we do that all the time, but at some point it becomes a difficult decision. And honestly, I would need to really think about that and hear both sides, because right now I don't know. I think you shouldn't have to vaccinate necessarily But it's the right thing to do. And the problem is, you know, that it would all be great if everybody did base their actions on all the evidence and what is the right thing to do. The problem is people don't. And so then you have people dying. And so it becomes a very difficult decision.
I mean, there's been a lot of aggressive education to try and counter the anti-vax movement. What else do you think can be done?
I don't know, to be honest, because these people don't, the people who are anti-vax are not weighing the evidence fairly and coming to a rational decision. They're basing it on things like, I gave my six-month-old daughter a shot, and now she's autistic. And so it's not a rational decision that's been made. And I'm not saying it's irrational and crazy. I'm just saying rational meaning it's not based on the evidence. A lot of things happen at the same time as other things. You can eat a sandwich and then the mail comes. But that doesn't mean every time you eat a sandwich, the mail's going to come. Vaccinations are given around the same time that symptoms of autism arise. That doesn't mean they're related to each other physically. It just means that they happen around the same time. So it's very difficult when somebody has made a decision based on this sort of faulty logic to reason your way out of it. And so these people aren't crazy. They're not stupid. They're just being human. And so when that something like that happens, it's really hard. I hate to say beliefs, but ideas that are based more on emotion than rationality. And, you know, if somebody tried to convince me that Doctor Who is a terrible show, I would argue against them. It's a great show. I love it. But that's not a rational argument. It's one based on emotion. And so it's a very difficult one to win.
I remember listening to NPR's Science Friday, and they had a caller come in, and they did the same thing. They said, you know, well, with this evidence, with that evidence, is there any evidence? And they said, no, there is no evidence. I can understand that kind of problem. You've created the blog, badastronomy.com. Is that one of your ways of trying to fight this, not this movement in particular, but the ignorance in general, perhaps, or the...
The scourge.
Yes.
Yes, that's it exactly. I started the website back in 1993. I got the domain name in 98. And it was basically just to counter myths and misconceptions about astronomy. It grew and grew. I started a newsletter. And then back in 2003, I think it was. I should really try to find out when I started it. No, it was 2005. That's right. I started the blog. And then in 2008, for those of you keeping notes at home, Discover Magazine... basically, they bought the blog. They made me an offer, and I moved it over there. And so now it's hosted. It's actually blogs.discovermagazine.com/badastronomy. And if you go to badastronomy.com, it takes you right to my blog. And it's more than just astronomy now. It's science in general. I fight against creationism. I fight against the anti-vax movement, all sorts of things. It's whatever I think happens to be important and that I have enough information that I feel I'm comfortable talking about.
Mainstream media, often under the guise of being balanced or fair, provides a platform for things like intelligent design, homeopathy, or the anti-vax movement to spew their, crap. Do you think mainstream media should take a stronger moral stance against these propagators of ignorance?
Yes. Oh, you want more? Yes, they should. Look, like I tell people, if you're talking about an issue like abortion, reasonable people can come down on opposite sides of an argument like that. And I can come up with 100 other political examples about this. When it comes to things like science, there is not two equal sides to this. And so if you're saying, I think the moon landings are faked, you're wrong. Okay, and so if somebody comes on TV and they want to see a debate between a scientist, like say me, and somebody who says the moon landings are faked, it's already not a fair fight because you've got somebody who is just simply dead wrong and spewing irrationality against somebody who has, you know, basically reality on their side. The news, they love to say we have both sides of this issue, of this controversy. But it's a manufactured controversy. It's not a real controversy. There is no scientific controversy about vaccines and autism. We know, the studies have shown, there is no relationship. Vaccines do not cause autism. We can state this factually. So if you have somebody who says that that's wrong, you're already giving them way more credence than you need to. The problem is the media are used to giving both sides of an issue. The problem is that sets up a false dichotomy, and then somebody might say, well, the truth sometimes, you know, lies somewhere in between. But you know what? If I take a cannon and shoot you with it, you're dead. And if you claim, no, I'm not, the truth is not somewhere in between. The truth is you're dead. And so that's the kind of thing that you have to think of when you see a debate between two people where they're arguing a scientific issue like the age of the universe or vaccines or evolution being a fact.
One of the best defenses against ignorance and the peddlers of pseudoscience is education. But it's hard to keep up these days. Are there any sources you would recommend for our listeners? Besides
well,
your blog, which is
about astronomy blog. In fact, there are three major forces in critical thinking in the United States, and that would be the James Randi Educational Foundation, which I'm the president of, and that's randi.org. I imagine your listeners are familiar with it, mm-hmm. randi.org. There's Michael Shermer's group, the Skeptics Society, out in California, and there's the Center for Inquiry, headquartered out of New York, CFI. And all three of these organizations are dedicated to promoting critical thinking and keeping up with what's going on out there. There are a million blogs. If you're interested in science-based medicine, if you're interested in the fight against the religious fundamentalists and creationism, there are blogs out there for you. The thing to do is to go find one or two blogs like that and then check their links, and you'll find far more than you could possibly read in a day.
Hello. And that was our part one of our interview with Dr. Philip Plait. Next week we'll have part two, so remember to tune in. But we'll be right back with a little bit of talk about a book after this commercial.
I'm gonna be around my vegetables. I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub. It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies. It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce. It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems. Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply. Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tennis flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
Okay, we're back. Now, Phil Plait mentioned this, and I'm going to be talking about it right now, and that's the anti-vaccination movement. And this is a movement that is bugged me from the day one, and I'm so anxious to get onto this. So,
were you vaccinated, Ethan?
I was, many times.
So was I.
Excellent. So, the anti-vaccination movement, there's lots of information out there. Most of my information comes from a great book called Autism's False Prophets by Dr. Paul Offit. And fantastic book. I really recommend our readers check it out. I'm going to read a quick quote from the opening of this book that Dr. Offit wrote. Every week, people send letters and emails calling me stupid, callous, an SOB, or a prostitute. Dr. Offit has been sent threatening letters, phone calls. He's even got threats on his children's lives. This is the mentality of the anti-vaccination movement. Agree or else. So, a vaccination. Well, it's an injection that we receive. It contains either a dead or modified microorganism. This teaches our body how to fight it in case a disease infects us in the future. And since the advent of the vaccine, humanity has successfully been able to eradicate several viruses, including polio and smallpox, a remarkable achievement for the human race, considering we once used leeches to treat the common cold.
Quite an improvement.
Very good. I hate leeches. Disgusting creatures. Within the last 20 years, people have claimed that vaccinations are not only dangerous, but they cause autism. And I'm going to be talking about this controversy, where it came from. It's a big topic. I probably won't be able to cover all of it. So I will recommend some great sources, including Autism's False Prophets. Please check them out. The situation began in 1998 when Andrew Wakefield, who is a gastroenterologist, meaning he studies the digestive system, claimed that the MMR vaccine, which is for measles, mumps, rubella, caused an infection in the intestines, which caused inflammation and allowed for harmful proteins to enter the bloodstream in the brain, causing autism. And Wakefield's claim caused a firestorm of activity. And he already occupied a prestigious position in London's Royal Free Hospital. He published his paper in The Lancet, which is a very respected medical journal. And the British press took this story to amazing heights. All over the country, newspapers announced that vaccines were harmful. And the result, thousands of children did not get the MMR vaccine. Over the next 3 years, MMR becomes public enemy number one, and Wakefield is a hero. In fact, they even made a docudrama TV show about Andrew Wakefield called Hear the Silence, and very, you know, one of those dumb TV movies. But by 2002, hundreds of children weren't vaccinated and were getting ill. In fact, three children tragically died in Ireland because of the measles. And in 2006, a 13-year-old boy was the first person to die of the measles in England for nearly a decade. Wow. Tragic. Wakefield had support from several other scientists. I'll mention some of them in a bit. However, it turns out these scientists had some other interests, and we'll talk about that in a second.
You know, I think it's funny, just before we go on too far, I noticed in doing some research for the show that Wakefield, his first claim wasn't actually against autism, was it? I read somewhere that he claimed that the measles vaccine caused Crohn's disease.
Yeah, and you think that after that was quickly disproven, he would be a bit more careful about going to the press with his scientific news.
Well, not only him being careful, the press would be a bit more leery about it.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, this whole story is all about lessons not learned. So, yes. So, Wakefield, he had his support from other scientists, and he decided to take this case to America. He had the help of a Republican congressman named Dan Burton, who is pretty famous for trying to get legislation passed that would have required AIDS testing for everyone in the United States of America. So he was his first ally. They set up a series of government trials to find out if MMR caused autism and, you know, if vaccines were safe. And during these hearings, Wakefield and his other scientists who supported him, well, they all testified. The American media took up the story, and 60 Minutes did a piece called The MMR Vaccine, in which Wakefield was interviewed, and he basically sat there and he said, MMR is not safe. So it was pretty grim. This is not good. In 2004, however, an investigative journalist in Britain, Brian Deer, uncovered evidence that Wakefield's study had bypassed medical procedure. He did not get ethical clearance for his studies. And the result was actually one child almost died because of his tests on this child. So anyway, he didn't get medical clearance, and he was also been paid $800,000 by a personal injury lawyer called Richard Barr.
Ah, so the real reason starts to come through.
Yeah, and so I mentioned he had help from other scientists. Well, they also received some, well, interesting sums. For example, John O'Leary, who worked at the Combs Women's Hospital, received over $1 million in compensation to his company. For example, Walter Spitzer of McGill University received $30,000. Kenneth Atkin of the Royal Hospital for Six Children received $400,000.
Why was this money spent again?
Well,
and
this
who spent
is
it? Sorry.
This money was all being given to these people by a personal injury lawyer, Richard Barr, who made a career of suing drug companies. So I'm beginning to sense a conflict of interest here. So anyway, in fact, the total amount of money was $1,530,000 was spent by Richard Barr's legal team on these studies. All this beside the point. Well, Wakefield's claim were never substantiated.
No, actually, you know, I was just thinking, as a skeptic, you know, there's an interesting thing there. Respect for authority. You know, just because someone who's a doctor says something, if the evidence doesn't back it up, you can't necessarily believe it. So we always say you trust scientists, believe scientists, and that's true. But even scientists are not above reproach, that what they need is the evidence behind them to prove what they say. In this case, we seem to have some people who if didn't have the evidence behind them, were at least questionable in their interpretation of it.
Yeah, and gets back to what we were talking about earlier. They cannot replicate Wakefield's results. Now, you think this would be the end, but it wasn't. The next installment in the anti-vaccination saga is the threat of mercury in vaccines. Now, vaccines did contain mercury, but there was a good reason. It was to keep them sterilized. And it wasn't methylmercury, which is a very harmful form of mercury which can cause mercury poisoning and it's very bad for you. It was, in fact, ethylmercury, which is far less toxic. In fact, adults could be injected with up to 2 million micrograms of ethylmercury and not suffer from mercury poisoning. And the ethyl mercury that was in vaccinations was actually a combination of other preservatives, and it was called thimerosal.
And I just go on that point. My research also shows here that children, I mean, because you mentioned adults, but children, if they're breastfeeding, can get up to 400 milligrams of mercury just from mother's milk in itself. So, I mean, even if this mercury was in there, even if it was toxic, which it wasn't, they were getting a far greater dose from the environment than they were ever getting from this vaccine.
Exactly. And so, again, we have a scared population, and a paper gets published in the Medical Hypothesis, which, by the way, is a journal with a circulation of about 200. That's not very big at all, that linked mercury poisoning with autism. And this theory was followed by experiments by a father and son team of Mark and David Geyer. They claimed that mercury from vaccines was causing autism, and they had a cure, which was a form of chelation therapy, which gave a binding agent to autistic children in the hopes that it would bind with mercury in their system and remove it. There were a number of other scientists who seemed to confirm that at least possibly there was a link between thimerosal and autism. However, politicians got involved. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wrote an article for Rolling Stone titled Deadly Immunity. He basically claimed a secret government plot involving big pharma and evil scientists had conspired to cover up the danger of thimerosal. Within a couple of weeks, Rolling Stone issued several retractions on this article, but the damage had been done. Thimerosal was now linked with conspiracy theories. Next, we have a journalist named David Kirby, who wrote a book called Evidence of Harm, Mercury in Vaccines and the Autism Epidemic, a Medical Controversy. And the American media ran with it just like Wakefield. Kirby appeared on national radio and talk shows, promoted his claims. Millions of Americans saw or heard him. But the thing was, thimerosal didn't cause autism. It was removed from vaccines about 7 years ago, and there was no drop in the rate of autism diagnosis. There were dozens of epidemiological studies, which are designed to show a link between factors, in this case autism and thimerosal, which showed that there were no connection between children who were given vaccines with thimerosal and children who were diagnosed with autism. There was no connection.
But okay, but then that leads to the thing. There has been a noticeable trend in an increased diagnosis of autism since, I think, what is it, the 80s?
Yeah, and that's partly because we've gotten better at diagnosing autism. And we're almost out of time, so I'm really going to jump to the end here. So it turns out that the Geyers aren't what they claim. They spent their career working as expert witnesses for law firms that sued vaccine makers. In fact, Richard Barr paid them $14,000. Since then, Mark Geyer has been thrown out as an expert witness. According to a judge, his testimony bordered on fraud.
I'm going to cut in just one last thing, because to get this in there, right? This anti-vax movement, it's done a lot. I mean, in Japan, there was another movement, similar situations. In 1974, they had 393 cases of whooping cough. I had whooping cough as a kid, so I know what it's like. But no one died. After this anti-vax movement swept Japan, by 1979, they had 13,000 cases, and out of that, 41 children had died. Now, these people who promote this anti-vax technique, they are killing people. People are dying. These people should be locked up and charged with murder. It is no less culpable in spewing out this crap and causing death. There's a death in Northern Australia caused by the same sort of mentality.
It's a very, very dangerous movement, and it needs to be countered. And for those of you out there who want to counter it, these are some great resources. Science-Based Medicine, Quackwatch, the Center for Disease and Control, the CCIAP, which is the Canadian version of, like, Vaccine Awareness Program. All these are great resources. Please check out Autism's False Prophets by Dr. Paul Offit. It's a fantastic resource. We really think it can really help people out. We're probably going to talk about this later in the coming weeks, so we'll get back to this story. But we really got to run. So, Don, can you give us a skeptical quote to close this show out?
Sure. This is from Dr. Martin Luther King. The soft-minded man is always fears change. He feels security in the status quo and is almost always a morbid fear of the new. For him, the greatest pain is the pain of a new idea. So you're listening to Radio Free Thinkers. This is Dawn, eyes open, mind on.
And this is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying good night and keep watching the skies.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub. It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right out. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
Modern Olympic records are usually fractured by only the tiniest of calibrations. A split second here, a millimeter there. And then there's Bob Beamon's long jump at the 1968 Mexico City Olympics, a leap that seemed to defy gravity and the laws of evolutionary progress. Beamon arrived in Mexico City to compete in the long jump, where the world record of 27 feet, 4 3/4